global business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
From Bloomberg World Headquarters, I'm Charlie Pellett. Stocks higher as Fed Chair Janet Yellen signals the central bank will be cautious on further interest rate increases. In a nod to those global risks, the S&P up 17, a gain of 0.9%. The Dow close to the best level of the day, up 100 points, up 0.6%. NASDAQ is up 1.7%. Gold up $22 the ounce to $1,241.80, a gain of 1.8%. Crude is down 2.6%. I'm Charlie Pellett. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash.
This is Taking Stock with Pim Fox and Kathleen Hayes on Bloomberg Radio.
Apple versus the FBI. The FBI changed course after it found that it was able to unlock the Apple iPhone involved in the San Bernardino shootings. However, having dropped the case, now Apple is saying, wait a minute, FBI, we want to know more about what you found. Joining us now from Bloomberg BNA in Washington, home of Bloomberg 99.1 on Bloomberg Radio, is Don Applin. He's Managing Editor of Privacy and Data Security for Bloomberg BNA, which is a leading source of legal, regulatory, and business information for professionals. So, Don, what exactly happened here?
Well, we don't know exactly what happened, except the FBI says, listen, thanks, but no thanks, Apple. We don't need to force you to help us anymore because somebody unidentified on the outside has helped us to hack in to the phone that was used in the terror attack in San Bernardino.
So why is Apple not saying, oh, thank you, no more legal fees, you know, glad it's over, and we're just going to, you know, head back to Cupertino?
Well, I think because, you know, the government pushed this whole issue of, you know, flaws in the encryption. Would there be a way for us to break into the encryption? And now they apparently have found a way to do that, and they aren't necessarily sharing that information with Apple. And Apple wants to protect its brand. It wants to make sure that it can assure its customers that they are going to be able to protect their customer data. So they need to find out what the flaw is so they can fix it.
Tell us about a relatively new process known as equities review and how these equities considerations play into what happens next.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is the government is under no real obligation to immediately turn over the flaw. They are, however, supposed to publish or let people know what that flaw is if it's in the public interest to do so. However, the countervailing part of it, just like there was in the debate about whether Apple should have helped them to unlock the phone, is, well, the government might be able to use this flaw beyond just this one situation and perhaps find a way to use it to unlock some other things that they're in the middle of doing. Now, there's some real questions about legally whether they can do that.
And what are those questions? It seems to me that this has – is this something that ultimately is kind of precedent-setting?
Well, it's not really precedent because it's not in the court. I mean, I think this very may well end up back in court. Apple may be forcing the issue in court. I mean, they certainly have made the point in the Brooklyn case, which is another case about a locked iPhone, that if the FBI knows how to unlock this stuff, why are we in court? You know, and just tell us what this is and we'll take care of it. I think Apple may actually force the issue by, you know, its own complaint, essentially.
Does this undercut the FBI, though, in terms of future claims saying, oh, you've got to unlock the phone for us because we don't know how?
Yeah. I think actually that's that tone of voice is absolutely correct. Kathleen, is it yes. So I think there is that element of, like, you know, cry wolf. And that there's some real concern that, you know, where's your credibility on this? What if you come back to Congress and say, oh, you have to give us this authority or you must let us do this, that they're actually, you know, speaking the truth. I think the flip side of that is that maybe the FBI really had no clue and that it was only because they, you know, dealt with people in third parties that they were able to do this. Maybe that would have never happened but for the lawsuit.
Don Applin, thank you so very much for joining us. Terrific conversation.
Sure, Kathleen.
Love to have you back because this is definitely not over. Don, of course, from Bloomberg BNA, Managing Editor of Privacy and Data Security. He's also an attorney. So this is a man, like all of our BNA people for Bloomberg, who know what they are talking about. Someone else who knows what they are talking about, and we're going to continue in terms of some big legal questions, is the U.S. Supreme Court deadlocked in one of its highest profile cases. They issued a 4-4 ruling that lets more than 20 states continue to require public sector workers to help fund the unions that represent them. Rania Sedham is back to Taking Stock on Bloomberg Radio, managing partner at the Sedholm Law Group. So, 4-4, what happened?
Well, they deadlocked, as indicated, 4-4. Four justices said that you should not have to pay those agency fees, and four said, oh, yes, you do. And now it's kicked back to the Court of Appeals level.
So what is at issue here? Tell people who maybe are not, have never belonged to a public sector union, about 5 million people like this in the country, a lot of them, of course, in California are teachers.
Right.
What does the law require anybody to do if they happen to be a teacher at a school that is covered by a public sector union?
Well, this is really for all public sector unions. It's not just teachers. That's why it's such an important case. But in any event, you have two options. One, you can either join the union and pay what everyone knows as union dues. And those dues are used for multiple activities, such as collective bargaining, political activity, and things of that nature. But if you don't want to join the union, you don't have to. But you still have to pay something called an agency fee. Some people refer to it as a fair share fee. There are lots of different nomenclature out there. But essentially, it's a fee to help support the collective bargaining activity.
Because you don't want someone to be a free rider. In other words, if I don't pay any union dues and everybody else does, and we get a better contract, then in a sense I'm a free rider. That's classic.
That's one of the arguments that is correct. I think really something that a lot of people aren't discussing that is of interest, at least to somebody like me, is whether or not the union should be the exclusive representative of the teachers. I mean, are there other solutions out there? Because as an attorney, of course, we can see both sides of every case, unless we're supporting one side over another, right? Because we're representing them. So I see both sides here.
So what would the other side be? I mean, because if I'm a teacher, if I support unions, I'm going to say, hey, the unions help me and everybody's got to chip in for the benefits we get. Is there, what would be the other way to handle this? What's the other side?
Another argument can be made that if you want to join the union, go ahead and join it, and then they will be your representative for purposes of collective bargaining, which means everybody who's in the union is under contract. And then for those that don't want to join, don't let them, quote unquote, free ride and have them represent themselves as an individual.
So this has, of course, a lot to do with the death of Justice Scalia just, what, a month and a half ago? That's because otherwise, apparently, this vote might have gone against the unions.
Yes, I think that's our best guess. It would have been 5-4 in favor of Ms. Fredericks.
Tell us a little bit more about Ms. Fredericks.
Well, she's a tenured teacher, and she's a grade school teacher, and she, you know, opposes this system because she says since it's a public, you know, union, everything that it does is political. You cannot separate political activity from collective bargaining. And in fact, when you start to drill down as to what is a chargeable activity, which means an activity that she has to pay into, one of those things is an NEA award program. NEA is the National Education Association. And at that program, there's fundraising for the PAC, which is a political action committee. So is that something that you should have to pay into or not? I mean, there are a lot of overlaps. There's nothing that's so clean and neat, right? There's gray everywhere. And as attorneys, that's what we're talking about, the gray.
Okay. And these, of course, are called, as you said, they're called agency fees.
Correct.
They're what the non-union member pays. And for teachers, if the dues are about $1,000 a year for employee, on average, people might get $350 to $400 as a refund if
correct.
They're not actually members of the union.
That is correct.
So is this a victory for the unions, or is there such a strong sense in the country that this is not a good way to do it among people who belong to public sector unions, that there's likely to be the next step to go to the states? Because if 22 states do this, it seems to me that if the Supreme Court doesn't back up the people who are against this, then their next recourse would be to try to get the laws changed.
Yes, and recently, there are a couple of states that did, you know, change the law, and I think the most famous one is in Wisconsin. I think it was called Article 10 or Proposition 10. I don't remember, but the number 10 was certainly there, and there was a rapid decline in the dues that were received from the union because the agency fees disappeared, and if you weren't in the union, you didn't pay into it. I do think this is a victory for unions because they definitely, you know, need a lot of money to support whatever it is that they're doing. Whether or not they should be an exclusive representative, that is something that, you know, I cannot opine on. It's such a complex issue. And I think whenever you are doing something collectively, obviously there's power in numbers. But whether or not each individual teacher that's part of this union is happy with whatever bargain they they're a part of, I don't know.
Well, of course, obviously four Supreme Court justices agreed. They did not support the idea that being forced to pay these agency fees to support the union constituted subsidizing third-party speech you do not support, because that's the case that they were trying to make on the side of Ms. Fredericks.
Sure, because part of the, you know, bargaining process, at least for a public sector, does involve some, you know, political stance, and that is part of your free speech.
Very quickly, is there any way this feeds over into non-public sector unions, auto unions, that sort of thing, and emboldens them or helps them even?
Well, I think it can. I mean, usually, you know, California is first to do something, and then we sort of take a wait-and-see approach, and then we either go with it or not. So it's the same thing with public sector versus private. The difference is in public sector, we're not going to be very happy if our garbage isn't collected or if our firemen say, I'm really sorry that the building is burning, but we're in the middle of bargaining right now.
Well, that would be very counterproductive. Rania Sedholm, thanks so much. Managing partner at the Sedholm Law Group. I'm Kathleen Hayes. This is Taking Stock on Bloomberg Radio.